Thank you, Harvey. Next would be Professor John Vohl, who is Professor of Islamic History at Georgetown University. He holds a PhD from Harvard, and that is in History and Middle East Studies, and he has, to his credit, no fewer than 8 books produced either as author, co-author, or editor, as well as professional involvements and affiliations that are far too numerous for us to detail here. His presentation is entitled Islam and the End of Secularism. Professor John Vohl.
It's a real pleasure to be here, although I have this feeling, having been here yesterday and today, that I represent a certain foil, that as I look at the title of our session this morning, there's, you know, religion and ethnic stuff, and then it says, conflict or conciliation. And in the discussions that we've had, we have been, I think, much more conscious of conflict than we have of conciliation. And so I perhaps am, to reverse the normal thing, I have this feeling that I'm kind of a sheep in wolf's clothing, that I'm coming as the quiet sheep to suggest that conservatism and religion and ethnic identities might involve conciliation and positive things. I enjoyed Michael's introduction, but I immediately wrote at the top, Michael was talking about religion as a problem. And actually, I'm going to talk about religion as a solution, not about religion as a problem. My basic framework, the thing that I really want to say, can be identified relatively simply. I'm going to make sure that my watch is set so that I can see it. My basic framework can be stated quite simply, and I would like to start with an observation from a sociologist of religion by the name of Rodney Stark in a journal called The Sociology of Religion about a year and a half ago, which I think we have reflections of in different ways already in a number of the comments today. Stark wrote in an article entitled Secularization RIP, he begins the article, for nearly 3 centuries, social scientists and assorted Western intellectuals have been promising the end of religion. Modernization is seen as the causal engine dragging the gods into retirement. 20 pages later, he concludes, "Let us declare an end to social scientific faith in the theory of secularization, recognizing that it was the product of wishful thinking. After nearly 3 centuries of utterly failed prophecies, it seems time to carry the secularization doctrine to the graveyard of failed theories." I think that what we are looking at is a world in which the idea that modernization necessarily involves the end of religion, that era is at an end. And as we look at the role of the United States in world affairs, the end of secularization, the end of secularism as an accepted dimension rather than as a competing ideology, the end of one era is upon us, and we need as believers, or we need as Americans, or we need as deformed Protestants, or as reformed Catholics. I mean, I have the interesting experience of being a Methodist preacher's son teaching at a Jesuit institution at Georgetown. In any of these, we are in an era where we need to re-recognize religion. Briefly stated, there are three things, there are three elements in this framework that I just want to state, and then let's look at the implications. The experience of the societies in the world in the past half century especially shows that modernization does not mean the end of religion as a major force in public life. That is, the secularization of society is not an inherent part of the process of modernization. Secondly, that policies of separation of church and state, or religion and politics, that such policies are not religiously neutral. That is, advocacy of secularization and secularism represents an ideological religious position. It is not an objective, value-free description of what happens in modernization. And thirdly, that means then that in policy terms, secularization is not just something that we observe as a part of the historical process of the last couple of centuries, but rather secularism can be recognized for what I think it has always been, and that is one of a number of competing visions of what society should be in the contemporary era. That is, we are at the end of a period when secularization has been taken as a given in the development of modern societies. We are at the end of secularization. Recognition of this is an important dimension of what has sometimes been spoken of as the resurgence of religion and religions at the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century. That is, again, what we are looking at and what we need to look at is this the idea of the secularization of society, and the idea that that's a good thing, is a part of a world of competing visions rather than just simply a social science description. Now, this is especially important in understanding contemporary Islam, where secularization has always been more clearly recognized as a competing ideology than as a fact of life. For two centuries, the major efforts for reform in the Muslim world have aimed at creating modern nations, modern states, and modern nation states. And in keeping with the earlier idea that that modernization somehow involved separating religion from public life, most of the modernizing reformers were identified with secularization. The key element in most modernization reform programs of the 19th and 20th century were then elements that involved a break with the past. And some of the great social science studies that came out in the 1950s and in the 1960s defining what modernization was made this clear. So that one of the textbooks that I used as a graduate student, long before many of you were sort of thinking about these things, I had a birthday on Friday, and so I was reminded of how old I am by my children. In the 1950s, there was a book called The Passing of Traditional Society by Daniel Lerner, which kind of set the vision of what modernization was. And in dealing with Turkey and with other countries, but specifically in the Turkey section, he talked about the people that he called the transitionals. That is, you had traditional people who still believed that religion was very important, and you had the modern people who believed that it wasn't important at all and that it was a matter for personal and individual life. And then he's describing the transitionals. The transitionals are acquiring psychic mobility, a personal capacity to identify widely and empathize readily. They are secularizing. They are becoming activist. In their view, problems are to be dealt with by policy rather than by prayer. Now, that was the picture of what a modernizing person was supposed to be. But as we reach now the end of that era of the domination of the religion of secularism as it looks at modernizing reform, we recognize that the, quote, really modern people by the 21st century are those who don't necessarily see policy as an alternative rather than prayer. What we have in our title, conflict or conciliation? Maybe it should be conflict and conciliation, or policy, not policy or prayer, but policy and prayer. The major modernizers were seen, however, in this secular perspective in the Muslim world, and as Americans look at that Muslim world, they see these modernizers very often as heroes. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk in Turkey and Kemalism. Kemal created the foundations for the modern society of Turkey that is one of our great allies. And Turkey has been one of our great allies in NATO, and Kemal becomes one of those people in the pantheon of good guys in international relations. And he was a good guy. But as we look at the question of religion in international affairs, it becomes important to recognize that Kemal created a society which was based on the assumption that it was necessary to take religion out of public life if you were going to have a modern society. Reza Shah Pahlavi in the 1920s in Iran and his son Muhammad Shah in the 1950s and 1960s operated under the same kind of rubric. You have other major cases as well within the Muslim world, and these are things that are seen as signs of modernization. So that as one looks at the descriptions of social modernization in the Middle East, most Americans, for example, see as important steps the having the women take off the veil. In Egypt, modernization is described as being an importantly triggered when a young female student come home from Europe, gets off in the 1920s, gets off the railroad train in Ramses Square, and steps out into the square and tears off her veil. And this is a good symbol of modernization. But I think that what we need to recognize is now that the idea of separating religion from public life, the idea that separating religion from public life is essential to be modern, is refuted by a good many of the people in this room, I'm sure, and is refuted as well by the experience of many countries in the Muslim world. And as we look at the Muslim world, and as I look at my watch and I see that I am at 10 minutes, as we look at the Muslim world, in the context of options for American policy. It is important to keep in our mind the framework that I have just mentioned in order to make sure that we look for the right allies, in order that we look for the right people to talk to, so that if we are talking about the moral reform of the United States, John Lenchowski at the end of his talk yesterday set a very nice sort of conclusion when he was saying that liberty requires a moral foundation and so on. Now, if we're operating within that framework, we don't go to an agnostic, near atheist novelist to find out, you know, to seek out our allies. And so if we don't do that in the United States, why should we do it when we deal with the Muslim world? Why should we see Salman Rushdie, for example, as a great Islamic moderate, one that we talk to, as opposed to looking at those people and talking with those people who think the same kinds of things that believing Americans do as well, and that is that religion does have a place in public policy. Religion does have a place in defining the kind of community that we are a part of. And in that kind of a context, the Ayatollah Khomeini, to put it as an extreme case, the Ayatollah Khomeini would have been a better ally for us than Salman Rushdie. But we are not stuck with having to choose between Salman Rushdie and the Ayatollah Khomeini. What we do have is, in the Islamic world, those people who have a sense of a morally based community with whom we can and with whom many people do talk. And I would just call your attention to a group that Tony Sullivan and I are a part of called the Halakha, which is on a small scale, an effort to provide vehicles for this kind of communication, where we have people like Anwar Ibrahim, who is unfortunately currently in jail in Malaysia, because he had disagreements over public financial policy with his prime minister. But we have a whole realm of people within the world who share our kinds of values. And in the era of the end of secularization as a given, and in an era when we have to recognize secularism as simply one of a competing set of ideologies, we can choose. And we don't have to deal with simply agnostic secularists when we go to the Muslim world. And in this, then, yes, there is a clash. Yes, there are conflicts. But the conflict is not Huntington's conflict between Islam and the West. The clash is rather between those who think that religion doesn't have a role in society, and there are plenty in this country that do, and those who believe religion does have a role. And in that, then, we have more natural allies in the Islamic world than we possibly do in a lot of places in the United States. Thank you very much.